Do you ever wonder what's happening behind the scenes of the multi-trillion dollar fashion industry? In the new podcast, Fashion People, Puck correspondent and 20-year fashion veteran Lauren Sherman and a rotating cast of industry insiders discuss what fashion people are really talking about behind the scenes of the star-studded business, from creative director switcheroos to M&A drama, DTC downfalls, and Met Gala mishaps. Fashion People, a presentation of Odyssey in partnership with Puck, is available now wherever you get your podcasts.
How many cameras do we have? 1, 2, 3. And who are they pointing at? I don't know what that one's doing. That one's doing me. All right. Hey, everybody. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm Molly Wood.
Oh, sorry. Make Me Smart. It's a podcast we do. Tech, the economy, culture, that whole deal. Also cameras.
Something about dots. We got really confused because we're in the same room again, which you know is always flummoxing.
And we don't know how to do that.
And there are like a whole bunch more cameras and lights, and nobody knows where to look. It's basically like that scene in Talladega Nights where the hands come up. Like, I don't know where to put my hands.
Never saw that one. Never said. Was that Tom Cruise telling it? Or was that Will Ferrell?
It's Will Ferrell doing the takeoff of the Tom Cruise movie.
Gotcha. All right. Thunder.
Super funny.
Whatever.
I will say 12-year-olds love it.
I, sadly, am not a 12-year-old.
I know, but...
So what we're...
You have one. None of us is smart.
How does
Thank
that
God you're here.
How does that get us to antitrust? Can you help me explain how that gets us to antitrust?
Well, there was a brief period in time where Will Ferrell was in every movie.
So that is... Oh, my God! That was so good. Loops are closed.
Dots were connected.
Anyway, so we are talking antitrust this week because Apple and the Supreme Court, they are going to meet up, Apple will, in the Supreme Court, about the App Store and whether or not it's using its ginormous power over the App Store to unfairly, one might say, hinder competition and raise prices.
Yep.
Right?
And in fact, the Supreme Court said, sure, consumers, go ahead and sue them.
Yeah. Yeah. And also Chris Hughes, who co-founded Facebook with Mark Zuckerberg back in that dorm room at Harvard, had a umpteen gazillion word piece in the New York Times like a weekish or so ago in which he said, we have to break up Facebook. Love Mark Zuckerberg to death, though he does. It is time for that company to be dismembered. So we are going to talk about that stuff this week.
Ooh, dismembered. Somebody watched Game of Thrones. And I'm assuming I have not watched it. Do not spoil it. When you said, by the
way. Are you kidding me? Do not spoil it. It's been 3 days.
I know, but I'm in L.A. I mean, you can, whatever. I'm just saving it. I'm going to watch it on my own time because I'm traveling. But yesterday I was listening to Kai's show live in the lobby like people do here in the L.A. office. And he said for the final, I'm going to talk about Game of Thrones and there's going to be a spoiler. I'm going to give you a few seconds. And I literally stood up. Your senior producer can attest.
Good.
And bolted from the, like, ran out of the room.
And I gave you the 3-1000.
Good job.
You know, yeah, that's right.
With the spoiler
that's
alert. Right. Yes. So anyway,
she made me, my senior producer did. I wasn't going to because...
It worked. I am appreciative. I'm going to, like, get her a fruit basket. Right. So anyway, this antitrust conversation used to be somewhat academic when we talked about it, like, 6 months ago on the show with Tim Wu, and he had just put out his book, The Curse of Bigness. And now... All of a sudden, it's a lot more real, and it's using a lot of the same language from that book. And so we thought it might be a good time to come back around and actually talk about, you know, the Gilded Age precedents that led us to where we are now.
See, we're gonna talk about very briefly here in the next 15 seconds of this podcast, Justice Louis Brandeis, who said, among many other things on the court, that we can and I'm paraphrasing, we can have a functioning democracy and a modern economy, or we can have all the power consolidated in the hands of a few who control all the wealth. And that is kind of where we're going today, because that, in a way, if you listen to Tim Wu, is where this economy has gone, right?
Yeah. And I think that is partly why now there is this honest-to-goodness new antitrust movement that is being called the new Brandeis School of Antitrust Thinking, which is why that was important background for you as we head into this. Or if you're trying to create dismissive headlines to not credit this new movement, you call it hipster antitrust.
Oh, is that what that's? I wonder where that
I did some reading on hipster antitrust, and I was like, wow, that is some insulting stuff right there. Anyway, well, I want to ask Rebecca what she thinks to talk about all of this with us and what this movement might mean for big tech and big companies all over the world. Rebecca Ha Allensworth is with us. She's an antitrust law professor at Vanderbilt University. Hey, Rebecca.
Hi.
How are you? Okay, well, first of all, what do you think about hipster antitrust?
Yeah, how do you feel about that?
Oh, well, the first thing I want to say is I take issue with the idea that the academic isn't real as a professor.
Touche, Rebecca.
Well, hipster antitrust. I'm with the people who thinks that that's insulting and that's not the word to use. So I call it new Brandeisian antitrust, and I think it's really interesting and exciting. I don't subscribe to it exactly, although it's hard to know exactly what it is. There's no manifesto I almost called it hipster antitrust. Uh-huh. There's no manifesto of new Brandeisian antitrust. I would say that one way in which I have a different opinion is I take it that the new Brandeisians think that companies and competition can be regulated directly in the public interest. So looking at things beyond just the economics of these companies to see whether or not they're too big, whether they're doing the wrong things. And I think we shouldn't yet throw out the idea of regulating only the economics of these companies. The thing is, this difference may be kind of academic, to use that word again.
But wait a minute.
Yeah, right?
Right. So are you saying you don't come down on the side that bigness alone is a problem?
I think bigness alone is a huge problem in our current economy as a matter of economics. And I think if we address that through the economic tools that antitrust has developed, especially if we take the idea of economics more seriously than we have in the last 40 years, I think that we can combat the bigness. Whereas, yes, I think bigness alone, without some sort of economic story about it, is not itself bad.
So explain that a little bit, right? Because what you have here are some companies in this economy. Facebook comes to mind just because we were talking about it with Chris Hughes. But also, you know, like Apple. I mean, explain how new Brandeisian, if you will, antitrust theory or however you interpret it might apply.
So I think the new Brandeisian theory would be you've got Apple that has all this market power. You have Facebook that has all this market power. And the way that they're using it is to, for example, in the Facebook example, they're using it to influence politics. Influencing politics itself is bad, and so we should address their ability to influence politics. I think of antitrust as being kind of like the First Amendment. So the First Amendment protects free speech. We all know that. And we know that speech is important for public discourse and exchange of ideas. Mm-hmm. I think all things being equal, most people don't like fake news. Most people don't like hate speech. But we worry if we directly regulate those things, we might have some unintended consequences. So instead, we regulate the free exchange of ideas, and we make sure that the government isn't overstepping and restricting speech in the hopes that when there's debate, the right answers will win. And, you know, we've seen that work not super well in the free speech context, mm-hmm. with the rise of fake news and the like. But I still think that antitrust has that potential if we decide to directly regulate. So the analogy would be in the First Amendment to say, this is hate speech, this is not hate speech, or this is fake, this is real, government saying that. Rather, we need to regulate the process of competition.
So how does that address one perceived limitation, maybe perceived and maybe real, of current antitrust law is that it relies on this standard of consumer harm, and that consumer harm is often interpreted to be higher prices. And that in the case of Apple, where it's possible that consumers are paying 30% more because apps have to give a 30% cut of all their in-app purchases to Apple, the higher prices thing is really easy to prove. Whereas with Facebook, the harm is very diffuse. It is confusing. It is hard to understand. It's hard to quantify. Like, do you think is part of new Brandeisian antitrust to say that existing regulations are equipped to deal with that diffuse harm?
Mm-hmm.
So I think this perfectly highlights the difference of opinion that I have with the new Brandeisian perspective. So to say that consumer harm can only be proved through prices, I think is just crazy. And that is what we have. And that is the law that we need to change. That's not economics. Economics is, as a discipline, is prepared to see lots of other things as examples of consumer harm, like breaches of privacy, like having fewer choices, like being stuck in an ecosystem with Apple when really what you want to do is to be able to buy some other product that you could interface with your other devices. Mm-hmm. And I think that to say that we need to throw out the idea of focusing on consumer harm throws the baby out with the bathwater. We can focus on consumer harm, but have a much broader perspective on what that consumer harm is. It's not written in the statutes, nor even really in the cases, that consumer harm has some particular definition in its dollars and cents.
Right.
So to me, or even that it has to be proved empirically, We've just built up 40 years of barriers for plaintiffs to prove their cases that don't need to be there, short of abandoning the idea of focusing on consumer harm.
All right. So can we talk remedy here for a second? Because you can see a way where the Apple remedy is pretty simple, right? It's some regulatory solution to what they can do with the App Store and the fees they can charge and the cut they can take and all of that stuff. Let's look at Facebook for a minute and use it as a representative of much of what else is going on in the digital and technology economy, right? If, as Chris Hughes said, somehow the government figures out how to regulate that company and they say you must spin off Instagram, you must spin off WhatsApp, how does that change or fix the problem, which is Facebook being used by bad actors to manipulate, democracy?
So I actually think the idea of splitting up Facebook is totally fine and actually a little bit modest. I mean, all we would be doing is taking Facebook back to where it was a couple of years ago. Facebook itself, that product, would still have a tremendous amount of market power right. And, you know, frankly, right. The ability to do harm.
So what's the remedy?
Right.
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I think what you would hope for is, with everything that has come to light since then about Facebook's misconduct and about Facebook's lack of privacy for its users and things like that, you would have something to turn to as a user when you're disgusted by Facebook's conduct. So, you know, everybody heard like, oh, you know, I'm done with Facebook. I'm only on Instagram now. Well, they're owned by the same company. Mm-hmm. So at least spinning them off and having different competitors then in that space might allow some switching. So, you know, it's like I said, it is relatively modest, because how many people are really going to give up Facebook in favor of Instagram? But it's kind of it's a counterfactual, because if they were separate, Facebook might start to look more like, Instagram might start to make itself look more like Facebook to compete more directly with Facebook. And then a fourth could come in.
So it sounds like you're saying competition, as with so many things, is the answer. And so breaking up these companies would be effective. Is there also an argument that regulating them could be enough?
Could be enough. I don't think so.
Okay.
I think that and this is an antitrust professor speaking. I'm an antitrust professor because I believe in competition. I think it's one of the most American values. I think it's great. I'm a super competitive person, you know. I think it makes me great. But you have to make sure that you have viable competitors, and it's not okay to just buy them up. And that's basically what happened with Instagram and WhatsApp. You know, you have a company that's starting to challenge Facebook's dominance, and what do? They buy them. So taking them back to where they were, and then saying going forward you're not going to be allowed to do this, I think would actually encourage different platforms to emerge. It's tricky in the social media context, because you've got some ways in which these things get big because of the network effects.
Right.
So, you know, you don't want to be on a platform that nobody else is on. Mm-hmm. But there is competition between platforms. People don't really talk about Twitter in this conversation. They have a much smaller market share. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I think competition between platforms is important. And I think whatever we can do to encourage that is good.
Let me channel Ken White. He's a First Amendment lawyer, friend of the podcast. We've had him on. You can look him up at Popat if you're listening. And I don't know, Rebecca, if you know Ken. But he would come on here and say, in essence, and I'm going to channel him. And Ken, if you're listening, you know, hit me up on Twitter. Don't screw with the First Amendment here, people, because this is an incredibly slippery slope. If we're regulating what people can or cannot say, and yes, I understand they're private companies, but if we're regulating, that is government regulating what people can or cannot say on, you know, Facebook or Twitter, Katie bar the door, you know?
So I would agree with him. I think directly regulating speech, just as I think that directly regulating what companies can and can't do in terms of their pricing, in terms of their products, is pretty tricky. And I don't think we should be doing that. I think that's what the First Amendment for. And frankly, I think that that's what the Sherman Act is for.
Mm-hmm.
So, hang on.
The Sherman Antitrust Act, which was passed in 1890, which is, oh, by the way, like 100 and umpteen years ago, and mm-hmm. the economy is completely different.
Right. Well, here's the thing about the Sherman Act. It's about a paragraph long, at least the part that was enacted. The part that was enacted in 1890 says almost nothing more than thou shalt encourage competition. And so in that sense, it's kind of like the Constitution, or, you know, a provision from the Constitution. And like a provision from the Constitution, its interpretation has evolved over the years.
So you're saying if it feels like the Sherman Act is not enough, it's because we have decided that the Sherman Act is not enough. See also tacit approval for T-Mobile and Sprint to merge today.
Right.
I mean, we don't seem to be, despite a lot of conversation, despite a what feels to be a growing antitrust movement, it does still feel like we're headed in some pretty opposite directions.
It's not that I think that the Sherman Act is outdated. It's I think that the case law interpreting the Sherman Act for the last 40 years is starting to look pretty outdated, and it's time to move the ball in that direction.
Fair enough. But your mention of the political process and a political solution to this gets me to my oft-repeated refrain on this podcast, which is the Congress of the United States can't find its backside with both hands. And you actually expect them to be able to do something as complicated as regulating, one of the biggest companies on the planet?
Yeah, I don't. And that's why I wouldn't favor direct regulation here.
Yeah.
But you know, the idea that the courts are not responsive to political pressure is also not true.
Yep.
And I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. There is tremendous political pressure against these big high-tech companies right now, and the law, as interpreted by courts, has always been susceptible to political pressure. And I don't necessarily think that that's illegitimate if it happens slowly. It's not going to happen in a case. It's not going to happen even in a year's worth of cases. It's going to take time. But I think that judges are now opening their eyes to the kinds of harms that these companies can engage in, and they're willing to reengage and reinterpret some of these tools that we have.
So it sounds like if you were going to propose some immediate steps, let's just go to like immediate solutions, you would say, because like I said last week, solutions-oriented lady, you're proposing that breaking up these companies is short-term likely the best approach.
I think that's true about Facebook.
And
breaking it up in the way that Chris Hughes suggests, which is spinning off these existing products that up until a few years ago were structurally separate. You know, what you worry about when you break up a company is how do you draw the lines? What part is going to be viable on its own? What part is not? Well, in the case of recent mergers, it's relatively easy for us to say, okay, you know, WhatsApp is a going concern and, you know, Facebook can compete with it. Breaking up other high-tech companies, is more complicated, and I'd have to, you know, look at it harder. I think having Apple not own the App Store is possible, but there's also a way in which Apple has an interest in only allowing users to use apps that work well with their phones.
Mm-hmm.
So controlling the App Store is one way to do that. Maybe it's a really anti-competitive way to do it, and maybe there should be a better way to do it. But that general argument that they should have some control over what people put on their phones makes a lot more sense than Facebook having control over every platform people use for their social media.
So one last thing before we cut you loose. You know, you mentioned that it'll take some time. And I guess my question is, do we have the time? Because Facebook's only getting bigger. Apple's only getting more powerful.
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah,
I mean, but, you know, we took down Standard Oil when they were pretty big.
That's true.
We took down Alcoa when it was pretty big.
That's true.
I think that a reinterpretation of the existing laws, even if Congress can't do anything in the short term, I think it can be very powerful. I mean, just ask Robert Bork.
Hmm.
Wow.
We'll have to explain that after we do some Googling on the break.
Man. Robert
Rebecca Bork. Ha Allensworth, antitrust law professor at Vanderbilt University. Rebecca, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me today.
See you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And
What?
That I am a believer in the power of consumer sentiment. And I actually do think that in the short term, that's a part of this, too. For example, although there is not much competition to Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, there is TikTok. And people are loving it.
Weird, man.
It's weird as hell.
Yeah.
But the kids love it. Like, there is always this kind of, there's a weird other hope in the idea that, I don't know, things pass.
Well, yeah, that's true, right? I mean, you know, MySpace? Hello?
Yeah, maybe this insanity will pass and something better will come along and people will feel better about it.
Send us your thoughts, your informed opinion, whatever you got on antitrust and these companies and what we ought to do and you know, maybe even whether it can work. Send us a voice memo, makemesmart@marketplace.org, and we'll get you on the pod.
Time for a short break and then our fixations.
Thank you.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Get one of the most successful broadcasts in television history on your schedule with the 60 Minutes podcast. Hard-hitting investigative reports, news, and culture maker interviews and in-depth profiles are waiting for you in every episode. Listen to 60 Minutes every Sunday wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back. Molly got to do it this time because she's here.
I'm in the studio.
Real time. No Comrex lag.
Nope. I can hear it. Ironically, there's never any Comrex lag for me. So when people talk about it, I'm always like, I don't know. It seems fine to me. I don't know.
Yeah, there's something Einsteinian
about
that.
I'm sorry you're being so awkward, but I feel great.
Oh, my God. So you know what's funny? I think for the first time, we have the same things.
No way.
Yes, we do. I mean, you've got three because, you know, Molly would.
Well, two of them are the same and one is a diversion.
Okay.
But you're right.
Please,
we do have the same thing.
We do.
Amazing.
That's kind of wild.
Because it is a huge deal.
It's a big deal. It's a big deal. So go ahead.
All right. Well, our thing is Huawei. And our thing is how the United States, by administrative order, has effectively said no American company can sell components or software to Huawei. Because Huawei, the company, the Chinese, of course, electronics and networking equipment giant.
We don't have the same thing.
Whoa.
Well, because you've got three here, and I'm looking at your number two. Look, Huawei is huge. Huawei is giant.
Is that not what we're talking
about?
That
was not my thing.
Oh, what's your
thing? I got a different thing. That Mark Warner, the ranking member on the Senate Intelligence Committee.
Oh, yeah, that's where I was going with that.
Okay, you were? All right. Well,
eventually.
Then I withdraw my previous remarks. Please continue.
Well, so like that
happens.
The gentle
lady will continue.
Okay, well, I'm going to do the setup, and you're going to do the spike.
Okay.
I'm going to bump set.
Oh, were you a volleyball player?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Where was I? Huawei.
I don't know.
Okay, so the Trump administration was like, you can't sell stuff to Huawei. And then Google was like, okay, I guess we won't.
Right.
I guess Huawei will not be able to use Android, for example. And it's just this, it became this instant escalation of the Cold War. And then
we learned through the Financial Times that what's happening, she's doing the bump set, whatever it is that volleyball players do. We learned that intelligence officials and lawmakers from the Congress of the United States are warning technology companies, like with classified information, that they should not be doing business with a lot of Chinese companies and enterprises and government-owned entities. And that is jibleepin-normous. Mm-hmm. It's kind of crazy. It's kind of crazy.
It's so, well, so what do you think as a former State Department guy and current spy? Like, what? I mean, what is... Because I think the question with Huawei in particular, right, is what is the actual threat level here? Like, how possible is it that Huawei's networking equipment could actually be spying on people or that its phones could be pre-installed?
1,000% possible.
So it's 1,000%
right.
possible. How right. unprecedented is it to find out that the government's having these meetings with tech companies being like, don't do it?
I think it's really, really interesting. I don't know whether it's unprecedented or not, but it would really surprise me if, say, 40 years ago, the FBI and CIA would have been having briefings with American companies about the Russians.
Right.
Right? I think this is...
Or Russian business dealings?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's up a notch because of, A, the increased globalization of this economy, and B, because of the nature of the global technology supply chain, which is incredibly integrated. It is very, very dynamic. People are looking for the cheapest modules, but they finding new supply chains is difficult. All of that stuff.
Yep.
And I think what's going on now, to quote a piece in the New York Times today, but also a piece that Marketplace Scott Tong did a week ago. There's this iron curtain now coming down in the global technology supply chain between the Chinese and us in the West. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating and it's huge.
I feel like it is just going to, the economic ripples have yet to even be explored. I mean, we saw, you know, Apple's share price, I think, was down like 3 points today because Huawei may be fine. Huawei is the second, just as one example, they're the second largest smartphone manufacturer in the world. They don't need the U.S. market. They're the second largest manufacturer in the world without the United States.
Yep.
Apple needs China.
Needs China, which is huge, right? So you better believe Tim Cook is like, humana, 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 humana.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, if now the Chinese are forced to, within their own country, build all of the smartphone components, whether it's the software or the things that they were previously buying from the United States themselves, then, you know, I am obsessed with parallel tech economy that has been built there already.
Yeah.
And the ambitions that China has with Beijing 2025 and the idea of just becoming a homegrown tech giant, this is only going to accelerate that, potentially to the detriment of U.S. companies, so that even if the security risks are real, the kind of long-term economic fallout starts to get really interesting.
And let me just, not to get too political, but it's interesting that this is all happening at a time when the political and media elite in this country are wondering whether Don McGahn is going to go testify on Capitol Hill or any one of a number of other Trump White House-related scandals that are sucking a lot of the actual news content time. I just think that's interesting.
Like, you think this is a distraction or this is like a big deal that's flying under the radar?
I think this is a huge deal that's flying under the radar because CNN and Fox and MSNBC are spending 36 hours a day going, oh my God, Jerry Nadler wrote a nasty letter to Steve Mnuchin about, you know, whatever.
Right.
You know,
I thought you were going to, I've been so checked out of that, that I thought you were going to somehow connect them again thing to I was like, wait, what? Where are we going with this? Because I am in fact fixated on the fact that I think the actual next Cold War was launched this week. I mean, this is economic warfare at the highest level.
I'm
going to
look the producers of this podcast right in the eye and say, if you don't hit that dark place thing right the heck now, I'm out. Okay. Thank you. I mean, come on. Molly was here talking Cold War, and everybody's like, oh, yeah. But Kai says, oh, it's a bad day. And boom, we get this thing. Come on.
You say it in the sad voices.
All right. Anyway, so that's we had a meeting of the minds.
Amazing.
In our little
And I brought a chaser.
Thing.
I brought a chaser because I knew it was going to get hella dark because it's like really serious. And I can't have just one because Gemini, we've talked about this.
Yes.
Somebody tweeted me, Stephanie K has tweeted me, about the proportion of peanut butter in Reese's candy. Because apparently a Reese's brand representative revealed that, in fact, the seasonal shapes, because, you know, I'm obsessed with the peanut butter eggs. We've talked about this on the show. I brought some to work that one day after I was in the weed lift.
Yes.
And it is true. Reese's has confirmed that the seasonal shapes have the highest proportion of peanut butter, a.k.a. why I love them.
Okay. Yay.
You don't remember the egg conversation at all, do you?
Vaguely. Look, it's a vast empty space inside my brain. I just, whatever's in front of me. Squirrel.
Stephanie Springer was like, all right, isn't Molly the one who's interested in this from like a year and a half ago? I love you, audience.
Oh,
love you guys.
Right. Shall we? Let us. Save
Hi,
us from
Kai
ourselves.
And Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Amen, my brother.
That's right. I'm going to make a prediction that all of next week's mail is going to be about peanut butter eggs
versus the
cups and which one is the better peanut butter ratio. Last week, though, we talked about important topics such as adapting to climate change and not dying, the ways that we will start to need to live differently in order to survive its worst effects. And we asked if you have already made changes to your life with climate in mind. Some of you said, yeah, duh. Essentially. Let's start with the more eloquent reading by Dr. John Sage Beal. He's an atmospheric and environmental chemist.
Wow.
You're all so much smarter than us.
No joke.
Based in Reno, Nevada.
They ought to come do this.
Early 2002, I began the process of designing and building my own zero net energy home. And I did the calculations myself. And I said, I'll be able to passively cool this house. In other words, not install mechanical air conditioning. For quite a long time, that worked very well. And about 4 years ago, I had to install mechanical air conditioning. That is, in a nutshell, climate adaptation.
Yeah, it totally is. And oh my God.
Yikes.
Yeah,
also, it's a dark place version,
It is a dark place version, right? But, you know, you got to spend money. There's need for more technology. And it's all about the mitigation window that we have, which, as we talked about last week, is kind of closing. And now we just got to adapt, right? Here is Joe Crockett, another PhD listener, definitely made life changes with climate in mind, has devoted his career to it. In fact, he studies how forests in the southwestern United States are going to continue to recover after severe wildfires, of which, by the way, we've been having a lot.
This is highly relevant.
Yeah.
I'm actually in the field right now taking measurements of young trees in areas that have been burned by fires to try to figure out how climate has affected their growth and their survival.
Okay, wait, Joe, you didn't give us the answer, man. How is what? You can't just leave us acting like that.
Did he change his job?
We're going to need a follow-up, right?
Yeah.
What are those young trees telling you? What are they telling you? Probably nothing good, right? Probably nothing good.
I don't know. Yeah. Well, also, back to the air conditioning thing, the nothing good about that is that I bought this book called Drawdown because I only read bummer books now that we're doing this climate change coverage.
Yes.
But they did this sort of scientific analysis of like the biggest areas that we'll have to address. And the biggest one is HVAC, because we get warmer and install more air conditioning, the more we pollute.
Right.
And it is the least virtuous cycle.
Right, right.
Ever, yeah.
Yay.
Yeah. Dawn Pruitt lives in Arizona. She says she is indeed taking climate change adaptation into her own hands.
We live in the hot Southwest, and we're super concerned about water usage. So we plan to use our tiny home as an Airbnb and are going to be switching the water toilet out for an incinerating toilet.
Whoa.
Who knows?
What?
Maybe that old George Strait song, Oceanfront Property in Arizona, will come true.
Okay, so
wait. Is that legal?
I don't know.
You can
know.
Burn can your you toilet burn, stuff?
Yeah, I mean, you get all kinds. I mean, that's what. Wow.
Okay.
And isn't that also polluting?
That seems pretty particularly.
Mm.
Ew.
Okay, moving on.
I'm not looking at you anymore.
Moving on. Shall we make me smart question?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right.
What is? Here's the question once more. What is something that you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? I did not think that you could burn particulates. Arlen Hamilton is the founder of the venture firm Backstage Capital, and it is a unique venture firm in Silicon Valley. It aims to fund companies with diverse founders, women and people of color, members of the LGBTQ community. And Arlen is a fantastic and outspoken member of the community and venture that is trying to make change. And here's her answer.
I thought I knew that there was some sort of success that you reach, and that was the pinnacle of something. Yeah. What I've learned is that it comes in waves, and that's actually more exciting and more interesting than having this main goal that you're looking for. And if you don't get to it, you haven't reached this mountaintop. I have never felt like I have arrived. People say that I'm successful and I don't feel it, and I think that's great. Because if I felt complacent, where would I go next?
Yeah, look, success does come in waves. And believe me, when you think you've arrived, you really haven't.
I love how often we get that answer, though. I feel like that is the adult condition, which is like, A, life is a journey and you're never done. And B, we all feel like we're faking it.
Right. Yeah, we all do. That's totally true.
Arlen, by the way, there's going to be a link to a profile of her, I think, in our show notes. She was on the cover of Fast Company last fall. Super interesting person.
Send us your voice memo. What is something you thought you knew but later found out you were wrong about? MakeMeSmart@marketplace.org. We'll get you on the pod. All right. Here we go. We're just sitting here looking at each other.
Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon. We're just waiting for the music.
Oh.
Make Me Smart is produced by Sharon Morris. Our senior producer is Steve Tro. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by...
Yes, it was.
I see him.
Yes.
Charlton Thorpe.
Yes.
I just had to take that opportunity. Our theme music was composed by Ben Holliday and Daniel Ramirez, both of whom I got to hang out with today.
Nice.
In person.
Nice. Ben Hethcote, who actually has come back on the job. I don't know where he was, but oh, look, one of the cameras just shut off. Ben Hethcote's back. Summer Dunsmore also here doing video stuff. The executive director of On Demand is Tar Nieves. The senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. I'm actually going to go back to the whole she doesn't listen thing.
Really?
Yeah.
Dang.
I'm back to it.
All
I'm
right.
1,000% back
Apparently
to it.
Apparently it's true.
And I will be called out if, you know.
Someday, potentially.
Or
apparently
yes,
no
but,
time
you know,
soon.
The climate's warming, so it's all going to be fine. You know. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my God. Is there cake? This is the second time we... This cake is probably for me, actually. That's probably from the last time I was here.
It is 100% for you. It is 100% for you. There we go. I'm going to get this out of the way.
Oh, that is so pretty.
Look at that. Are those edible flowers? Are those California poppies?
But I didn't bring my phone. Now I can't take it. But will you take a picture?
Why did you not bring your phone?
You're so awesome. I was trying to be responsible. Like, no phones at the dinner table.
This cake is delicious.
I don't know. It's a really good cake. This is basically, like, the funnest 6 days of my entire life.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.